Kamal did not exist before this episode. What they are about to describe is happening across London as you listen. This is their story. This is about NHS training in one of the most deprived constituencies in the country, where qualified healthcare workers cannot access the courses that would put them on understaffed wards. Kamal's experience reveals how Treasury spending limits treat nursing education as a cost to be rationed, even when hospitals have empty beds and patients wait for care that trained staff could provide.
I knew I wanted to be a nurse from the moment my sister Elif was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when she was 14. Watching her navigate the overstretched services at King George Hospital, seeing how the staff rushed between patients because there simply weren't enough of them, I understood that becoming a nurse wasn't just a career choice. It was necessary. My parents had run a corner shop in Dagenham for 20 years, working every hour to build something solid for us. I wanted to do the same in healthcare. I spent 3 years as a healthcare assistant at Barking, Havering and Redbridge University Hospitals NHS Trust while studying for my degree part-time through the Open University. The psychiatric wards were the most understaffed. Nurses worked double shifts, patients waited weeks for assessments, and agency staff who didn't know the systems filled the gaps at twice the cost. I applied for a mental health nursing degree at the University of East London in 2022, convinced this was where I could make the biggest difference. The admissions interview went perfectly. The panel praised my experience and dedication. I had everything they were looking for. Relevant qualifications, direct patient care experience, and genuine commitment to mental health nursing. Then came the call I wasn't expecting. "We'd love to offer you a place," the admissions officer said, "but we can't. Health Education England has capped our funded training places at 80% of last year's allocation. The money simply isn't there." I asked what that meant. She explained that the university could only run courses for students with funded places, and those numbers had been cut from Westminster. I could apply as a self-funded student, but that would cost £27,000 over 3 years, plus living expenses. On a healthcare assistant salary, that was impossible. I tried Middlesex University next, then City, University of London. Same answer every time. The courses existed. The lecturers existed. The clinical placements were available. But the funding had been capped, and universities couldn't run programs without it. I contacted NHS England directly. I'd counted 47 unfilled nursing vacancies across Barking and Dagenham CCG that month. Surely they could see the connection between training cuts and staffing shortages. "We're operating within Treasury spending constraints," came the reply. "Public sector workforce investment has been limited.
We understand your frustration, but we have to work within the budgets we're allocated." I pushed back. I explained that I was already working in the NHS, that I could see the gaps every day, that training me wouldn't be creating a new cost, but filling an existing need. The response was polite but final. "These decisions are made at a national level based on available funding." For months, I accepted this. It sounded reasonable. Budgets are finite. Money has to come from somewhere. Everyone understood that. I volunteered at Mind, in Barking and Dagenham, while I waited to reapply the following year. That's where I met Aisha, a qualified psychiatric nurse from Nigeria, whose credentials weren't being recognised. She'd been waiting 18 months for her assessment, working in a care home instead of using her specialist training. There was Dimitri from Romania, who'd trained at one of Europe's top medical schools, driving for Uber because the NHS couldn't process his paperwork fast enough. In the same building, we ran support groups for people struggling with depression and anxiety, many of whom needed the kind of specialist care that Ayesha and Dimitri could provide. The demand was overwhelming. The expertise was sitting right there, unused. One evening in November, I walked past the University of East London's nursing building on my way home from a late shift. The lights were off except for the security desk. I asked the guard about the empty floors. "Those are the simulation labs," he said. "State-of-the-art equipment, but they only use the building 2 days a week now. Can't afford to run more courses, apparently. Shame, really. All that gear just sitting there." I looked through the windows at rows of hospital beds, ventilators, and monitoring equipment covered in dust sheets. This was the same week I'd worked a shift where we had one qualified nurse covering 36 patients because two positions were unfilled and the agency couldn't send replacements. That's when it stopped making sense. The people existed. I was one of them, ready to train. Ayesha and Dimitri were already trained, waiting for recognition. The patients existed, filling every bed and waiting list. The buildings existed, mostly empty. The equipment existed under dust covers. The lecturers existed, many of them part-time because they couldn't get full contracts. What exactly was it that there was no money for? The UK government issues the pound. When it spends, it creates money by instructing the Bank of England to credit accounts. It doesn't need to find pounds in a vault before it pays for nursing courses. Treasury spending constraints aren't natural laws. They're choices. I started to see the same pattern everywhere. Empty training centres next to job centres full of people who wanted to retrain. Unused university facilities while courses were cancelled for lack of funding. Qualified professionals from overseas waiting for paperwork while employers complained about skill shortages. The government that prints the notes and mints the coins was telling me it couldn't find enough of them to train the people who were standing right there, ready to work. But it found £895 billion for quantitative easing after the 2008 crash. It found whatever it took for furlough during the pandemic. It finds unlimited amounts for tax cuts that never require anyone to ask where the money comes from. The real question was never about money. It was about whether the people existed, whether the skills could be taught, whether the materials were available. They were. All of them. The excuse was not a fact. It was a choice wrapped in the language of impossibility. It's the same logic as a household that says, "We cannot afford it," except a household doesn't issue its own currency. The government does. The limit was never the money. The limit was the willingness to spend it into the places and the people who needed it. I'm still here, still watching, still applying. But I understand now that what happened to me wasn't bad luck or natural scarcity. It was a series of political choices made by people who had alternatives. Every unfilled nursing position, every cancelled course, every qualified professional sitting idle, traces back to the decision to treat public investment as a cost to be minimized rather than the mechanism by which resources reach the people who need them. This isn't just my story. Walk through any constituency where hospital wards are understaffed while universities run half empty, and you'll find the same pattern. The government that creates the currency chose not to create enough of it to connect the people to the work. That choice has a cost, and patients are paying it.
What Kamal experienced has a name. Impossible expectations. This technique demands a guarantee of zero waste or perfect outcomes before committing a single pound. A standard never applied to tax cuts or bank bailouts. It's like rejecting all antibiotics because some patients might experience side effects, ignoring the overwhelming evidence that they save lives. In healthcare, impossible expectations works by demanding proof that training nurses will solve every staffing problem instantly and permanently. Any example of a trained nurse who later left the profession becomes evidence that training is wasteful. Meanwhile, the overwhelming success of nursing education, the thousands of qualified professionals providing essential care, the measurable improvement in patient outcomes when wards are properly staffed, all of this is dismissed as insufficient evidence. Kamal met dozens of qualified nurses whose skills weren't being recognized, while policymakers demanded certainty that new training places would never be wasted. The same Treasury that found unlimited funds for quantitative easing required exhaustive proof of return on investment before training a single additional nurse. The UK government issues its own currency. It does not need to find pounds before it spends them. The real constraint is resources. People, skills, materials, time. In Kamal's constituency, those resources were sitting idle. The resources existed. The people existed. The decision not to connect them was political, not financial. Barking ranks 79 out of 543 English constituencies in the English Indices of Deprivation 2025 from MHCLG, placing it in deprivation decile 2. The constituency has 543 registered charities, according to the Charity Commission Register for England and Wales. These organisations received £16.4 million in total grants, according to 360 Giving Grant Nav. All sources are published at blockedbritain.co.uk. Blocked Britain tells the stories of people whose lives are shaped by the gap between what Britain needs and what its institutions choose to provide. Every character is fictional. Every situation is drawn from official statistics. Produced by Blocked Britain.